ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
It's Monday, and that means we have another installment of the Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. With us this week is Daily Maverick journalist Michelle Bunder. Here's what's coming your way. Labor Department raids expose dodgy employers. Then, the Lusiki Siki massacre reignites the illegal firearms conversation.
I think with the Lusiki Siki massacre, they need to set an example that this can't be acceptable in our country because it happened in Nomzamo Tavern 2 years ago. To this day, justice has not been served. No one is behind bars for that massacre.
Later, the 10th of October is D-Day for Durban as taps run dry. And a fascinating study on how viable a universal grant could be in South Africa. But first, the city of Tshwane finds itself rudderless once more, as city mayor Celia Brink is kicked from his mayoral seat. However, he might still make a triumphant return. Meanwhile, a few more candidates are waiting in the wings. Michelle, welcome back to the show. It's been a good while since our last chat. How have you been?
I've been well. Cold, though. It's been a very cold, but I'm well. Thank you. It's good to be back.
So let's talk about the city of Tshwane. It's not necessarily the end of the road for Celia Brink, as he could be voted back in as Tshwane mayor. That's if the DA, of course, has its way. This comes after Brink was ousted in a no-confidence vote just over a week ago. First, I want us to talk about the state of coalition governments across the various metros. I mean, Joburg has had its fair share. They're really clinging on for dear life in eThekwini and Ekurhuleni. How hopeful are you that the various parties can actually make this whole coalition government thing work?
At the rate things are moving, I don't think I have too much hope on the coalition government because it seems that the people in power are not there for the collective, you know, of serving the people that voted them in power. It's more about the politicking for me, more than the issues at hand that different municipalities face. So to an extent, that for me is just like a cause of concern. I'm worried as to, okay, if we're seeing it on a municipal level, what happens on national government if they can't find ground on local levels? So for me, it's not hopeful. I have no hope whatsoever.
At the rate things are going right now, especially looking at Tshwane, it just seems like it's more of the same. You know, there's infighting, bickering, threats of parties leaving the coalition government if they don't get their way. So I want us to look at the candidates vying for the mayoral position. There's, of course, Celia Brink, who, with Helen Zille's backing, I mean, we've all seen that really, really strongly worded letter, is fighting to get his job back. And then we have ANC candidates Khosi Mayepa and George Matshila. Both have played integral roles alongside ANC big names such as the electricity minister, Khosientso Ramokopa. And then we also have Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi's right-hand man from the sidelines. And I think they are probably the most hopeful out of everyone is Action SA with Dr. Nasipi Moya. And I found this quite laughable, but the party said that they believe they have been cheated out of the position of mayor of Tshwane. But who do you see will most likely grab the mayoral seat? Do you see Brink maybe getting his role back?
I think more than anything, at this point, you can't be too sure. I can see Brink going back to mayorship. Reason being, he's been there. He knows the city quite well. And for the GNU to work, the DA is, you know, to say, if you don't put our person back, it affects the GNU. But you never know. It's politics. Anything can happen. There could be another fifth or sixth candidate coming up on the day of voting.
Definitely. It could still deliver a fair amount of surprises. But I think to wrap this up, regardless of really who takes the role, overall, the Gauteng government of provincial unity, as with many other provinces, will really continue to suffer unless power sharing agreements start to work. And I think that for me, those are the key words summarizing all of this is power sharing. And it seems that's just something several political parties are simply unable or unwilling to do, is to share power. And that is what it all comes down to.
Certainly, because I think at some point it needs to get like directive from the national government and translating and becoming a thread right through to local level. Because at this point on national government, it looks like it's working and it looks like there's less chaos. But when it comes to the provincial level and the municipal level, it's not really translating. For instance, in Gauteng, you can see that the DA and the ANC are not trying to come together for the greater good of serving the people of Gauteng. Thus, GNU has to translate in all stages and all levels of government. Otherwise, we'll find ourselves in the same situation over and over again.
In September, popular Pretoria restaurant Babel made headlines following allegations of its owners mistreating employees and allegedly contravening labor laws. The claims went viral, leading to many other workers speaking out about their experiences within the hospitality sector. The owners of Babel were subsequently arrested on various charges, but the conversation around unfair labor practices continues. In response, the Department of Labor launched a number of raids and inspections on various businesses across the country.
Let's talk Operation Yazini. This is a series of blitz inspections, as the Department of Employment and Labor described it. And the raids come after Minister Meth announced in July that her department will be ramping up nationwide inspections specifically targeting non-compliant employers. Now, the department provided feedback on these raids last week, and I understand that you were following that closely. What were some of the findings that came from this feedback session from the department?
So some of the key points that came out of that was that the department actually undertook 2,681 inspections across the country, of which 49% of these inspections, the establishments or the businesses that were inspected, were found to be non-compliant to various labor laws, including the minimum wage, basic working conditions, occupational health and safety, compensation for occupational injuries and diseases, the Unemployment Insurance Act, promoting fairness and protecting workers, and others. And the other aspect of it was the department establishing a way forward with these raids, because it seems rather from the public perspective, they were reactive of what had recently happened, despite the minister having announced that they would undertake these prior to the reports about the Babel restaurant in Pretoria.
I was about to say as well that I think the raids are especially relevant now, following that heated social media conversation around specifically unfair labor practices in the hospitality industry and restaurants. But I think a lot of people are perhaps asking why now? Because these complaints around unfair labor practices have been around for years. I mean, we've reported on it many times. Daily Maverick has reported on it numerous times. And some are saying that the department's been asleep at the wheel, really, when it comes to labor matters. And the only reason they're really talking about it now is because of the online discussions happening. So is this all for show?
Having engaged with the department, for sure it felt like they are rather reactive to what has happened than preventative. But at the same time, it doesn't have to take the department to conduct raids in order for businesses or establishments to be compliant. everyone has to come to the party as far as compliance is involved, because they can do the raids and the next day the businesses go back to, you know, non-compliance. So it takes a lot more than that. It needs everyone to come to the same agreement to say, we want to do this, we want to do it right. Because these issues, they are intertwined also with Home Affairs. 81 foreign nationals who did not have correct documentation have been arrested during these raids. So it says a lot about not just one department, but a lot of other departments and just the interlink and the coordination that happens there. So as the minister said, they will recruit 20,000 more inspectors to deal with the situation, as they currently have about 2,000.
And with these raids, you mentioned the arrests, but what else came from the raids? Because it's one thing saying we've identified all of these institutions and that they are not above board, but what is the department actually doing to address those failings?
So they said they would be prioritizing the high-risk areas, and the areas that are high-risk are predominantly Gauteng, the Western Cape, and KZN. That's where the most inspections were done. They mentioned that employees are scared to report certain non-compliance issues because they're scared for their jobs. What happens to them after that? So just, you know, a plan to increase inspectors and prioritizing high-risk areas through a profiling system.
At the end of September, the country was rocked by the brutal killing of 18 people at two homesteads in Lusikisiki in the Eastern Cape. According to early reports, unidentified gunmen opened fire on the two homes, practically wiping out an entire family. At the time of this recording, no arrests had been made. The incident once again highlights authorities' losing battle against illegal firearms flooding our streets. So, could a UK initiative be the answer?
Now, let's move our focus to the Lusikisiki massacre that really shocked the country just over a week ago. Last week, Wednesday, Police Minister Senzo Mkhunu said arrests were imminent following the brutal killing of 18 people in Ngobozana village. The details coming to light are truly terrifying. One of the survivors told News 24 that the gunshots lasted for about 10 minutes, which I cannot even wrap my mind around. This is such a horrific story.
It is indeed horrific, but at the same time, we are not surprised because the problem has long existed in the country and it has been happening, and there seems to be no solution whatsoever as to how do we deal with these illegal firearms. But also at the same time, we find that also the SAPS have an issue where they are losing their firearms. Their firearms are also being stolen. And sometimes you wonder, is it not the very same firearms that were stolen from them that are used to commit the crimes? Or where do these firearms come from?
And I mean, we've seen that in the Western Cape as well with the gang violence there. Many of the guns there used by various gangs are stolen guns, usually. We did a fantastic investigation last year sometime about stolen guns being taken from police storage, which is just crazy in itself. And I think, as you've just rightfully mentioned, is that this incident, the Lusikisiki incident, has really reignited the conversation around firearms and in particular illegal firearms. You mentioned that the SAPS, they've lost weapons of their own. I think a figure that I read was around 300 SAPS firearms and 30,000 rounds of ammunition were lost or stolen between October last year and March this year. So, I mean, clearly, we need to address this issue because this is what is literally keeping the crime in our country running. I know there's been a growing emphasis also on gun confiscation and incentivizing the surrender of illegal firearms. The Mail and Guardian recently reported on successes of the UK's so-called zombie knives campaign, which I found very interesting. And that basically said that citizens are free to hand in their weapons, no questions asked, while also receiving some form of compensation. It's a small amount, but it's something. So do you think maybe a system like this could work in South Africa?
Maybe you're right. Maybe that's what we currently need. And even so, I think with the Lusukisiki massacre, they need to set an example that this can't be acceptable in our country because it happened in Nomzamo Tavern 2 years ago. To this day, justice has not been served. No one is behind bars for that massacre. But we know that 16 people were killed and 7 were injured in that massacre. So the least they can do is set an example that this can't happen again. Because if there is no solution, we are likely to see more of these things happening.
Etiquini residents are in for a rough couple of months as a strict 12-month water rationing period comes into effect this coming Thursday. With the municipality losing at least 54% of its water revenue to leaks, theft and unbilled consumption, it's a crisis long in the making. So, what went wrong?
Now, if you're in Durban and surrounds, listen up, because from the 10th of October, new water restrictions will come into effect across the metro. The announcement follows a directive from government that states the metro has to reduce its water consumption by 8.4% over the next 12 months. And basically, this means that Etiquini residents will be subjected to water rationing for the next year. Now, really, this is such a sad state of affairs, and I feel that this is just a sign of things to come for many other provinces across the country as well.
Certainly. However, with Etiquini, I'm quite shocked that they're actually making such an announcement now when the city has been facing a lot of water issues. If I'm not mistaken, it's been over a year that there have been water issues, initially blamed on the floods, and then it was issues of vandalism on the infrastructure. And at some point, they were saying it's being targeted, it's sabotage, but they're only saying something now. Because I know of people who don't have water on a daily basis in Etiquini, and these water tankers have actually become a norm for them. And they're telling me, we don't have water during the day. Maybe at night, sometimes it comes through. But yeah, we'll have to wait for tankers throughout the day that are also not enough to supply the rest of the community. And you can't also get enough for your own personal use.
Because I remember speaking to people that I know in Durban saying that back in 2021 already, residents were slapped with a so-called water infrastructure levy. And the aim from that was apparently to raise over R1 billion to address the many water issues in the metro. Nothing really has come from that. Then we had July 2023, where the National Department of Water and Sanitation issued the directive that we're speaking of now, telling Etiquini to clean up its act or else they will have to start implementing water rationing. So very little has happened during this time. And I'm really just wondering what more needs to happen before municipalities wake up and start actually doing their jobs and fixing leaks, fixing the water infrastructure, because clearly it's not happening.
Certainly, they need to start fixing it. This is a nationwide problem. It's not just Etiquini. So we are yet to see how it translates in other provinces, cities and towns.
Well, day zero seems to be back on the table for many provinces. I'm seeing the term being thrown around quite a lot again. Of course, we remember the day zero crisis that happened in the Western Cape. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
At 33.5%, South Africa has the highest unemployment rate in the world. When taking the expanded unemployment rate into account, the country is facing a sobering 42.6% unemployment rate. As the country faces a worsening jobs bloodbath, some organizations are looking at novel ways to tackle joblessness, more specifically youth unemployment. A new study funded by the German Catholic Bishops' Organization and the Pietermaritzburg Justice and Dignity Group shows the positive impact a universal grant could have.
Now I want us to move on to some good news. And this one is really interesting. First, I want to hear from you. Have you ever heard of the Unconditional Cash Transfer Project?
I had not heard about it until the initial story on the Daily Maverick website. I did not know about this.
Yeah, I was also completely unaware of this project, I'll be honest, but it's fascinating, really. It's a fascinating study that's been running since October 2022 to see whether a universal grant could actually work in South Africa. And it's such a simple concept. So we have, for the past 2 years, 100 unemployed technical college graduates in KZN who have been given 2,000 rands per month to spend as they wish. There are no limits. They don't tell them you have to spend it on setting up a company. You don't have to spend it on groceries. They literally tell them, do whatever you like with it. And negative people might think, you know, oh, they went and bought alcohol and they went to party, but that's actually not the case. It was actually very interesting to see that the majority of the 100 applicants actually spent the money very wisely. I thought this was such an interesting study.
It is quite interesting what people can do because, I mean, 2,000 to even speak of it, it's not much, but what people can do with that in comparison to the 350, 2,000 is quite a lot, and how they've tried and used it to regenerate the income and make it more for sustenance is quite amazing. But also, I'm quite interested as to why would they particularly select that group that has just recently graduated, you know?
Yeah, I think it was more because they are skilled in such a way that they can work on farms, they can become plumbers, they can do construction work, mechanics, you know, the things that basically keep the economy running. So I think that's the primary reason why they selected technical college students specifically. And it was also very interesting for me because many of them used that for data, transport fees, and so forth in the whole job hunting game, because we know that requires money in itself. So a lot of them used some of the money towards that. There was a lovely story of one of the individuals who used that money to set up a small vegetable garden, and then she started selling the produce, which I found just a lovely idea. And overall, around 73% of the families involved in this study ended up saying that they no longer ran out of money at the end of the month. So it shows that that small amount really makes a massive difference in the living quality of people across the country. So maybe a universal grant is the way to go. I don't know.
Certainly. Well, it's still an ongoing conversation, but I think it is a way to go. Give people the money and see what they can do. If they're not making good decisions about that money, then it's on them. But if they are, then that's good also for the country.
Absolutely. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Hallway Grab. Michelle, it's been an absolute pleasure spending time with you, and I really hope you have a wonderful week further.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Hallway Grab. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.